Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on what does it mean to be compliant in today's ARM industry? Compliance can feel like a moving target in the credit collection industry, and just when an agency thinks it has compliance on lockdown, a new law is passed, or a new court ruling is issued, and the goalposts get moved further away. Today, a panel of credit and collection industry executives will share their insights into what they think it means to be compliant and how to achieve it or get as close to it as possible. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Arbyte Software. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick second and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site's free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me now tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is Vice President of Legal and Compliance and Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. Kelly serves on the board of directors for the Receivables Management Association International and is an ACA certified instructor. She also served as a small entity representative for the arbitration and debt collection rulemaking. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, can be found on Podbean, and Collection Advisor Magazine named her one of the 20 most powerful women in collections in 2018. Alicia McKeegan is the Chief Compliance Officer at AFNI Inc. She's been in the industry for 10 years and has experience building and enhancing AFNI's compliance management system. She also has experience with the FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA litigation and regulatory licensing. She's a member of the ACA Federal Affairs Committee and holds a credit and collection compliance officer designation with ACA. W. Judd Peek is responsible for the creation, implementation, and continual oversight of the enterprise-wide compliance management system at the Frost Arnett Company. In this role, he ensures that the compliance program aligns with the overall corporate strategy, business plan, and code of ethics of Frost Arnett. Judd also oversees multiple compliance information tracking and monitoring systems. Prior to his role as Chief Compliance Officer, Judd spent 16 years as an attorney in private practice, specializing in employee relations issues. The format for today's webinar is a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I just wanted to ask everyone to take a minute before we get too far into the webinar today to fill out a survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over. There's also a link on one of the slides that are scrolling through the presentation. And you'll receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that is what you are looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from. And one lucky survey participant will even win a Starbucks gift card. So please take a minute and participate. With that, let's launch into today's discussion. And first, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and have each of the speakers talk about how they define compliance and maybe talk a little bit how that definition has changed in recent years. Kelly, would you mind going first?
Thank you very much, Mike. Very excited to be here with Judd and Alicia. So I think that the definition of compliance has changed a lot. Well, maybe not changed per se, but has really expanded a lot over the past several years. I think that ever since, the CFPB became interested in collection agencies and what we were doing, we've started to expand on what our CMS includes and how we are evaluating compliance in every way that our compliance with the federal laws, with the state laws, with the local regulations touches each point of our business. And I think now most folks in the industry have very strong compliance management systems that they're using to regularly monitor changes that are happening and update their practices so that you know, we're sure that we're in compliance with the ever-changing landscape of regulations, whether it's an act of a regulator or whether it's, you know, a court that comes out with a new decision. And thanks to, you know, folks like yourself, Mike, you know, who are regularly sending out notices about new cases and new laws that help us stay on top of those things. That was unsolicited, by the way.
Awesome. Thank you. It's always appreciated. Alicia, what about your definition?
Sure. And again, thank you, Mike, for allowing us to present, and excited to be here and present with Judd and Kelly as well. So compliance in the industry has changed a little bit, as Kelly said. My definition would be more about achieving excellence in designing controls in order to comply with the regulations. And I use the word excellence because perfection is really not something that is achievable. So designing the best controls that you can through people, processes, and technology is how I would define compliance. And again, as Kelly had said with the CFPB, we've paid a lot more attention to some of the informal expectations that have come from our regulatory authorities, such as the CFPB. A lot of the case law that's coming out, you know, you see different things on interest disclosures and statute of limitations and, you know, what the creditor name should be. And so, you know, different types of case law and then other agency best practices. I talk a lot with my peers on what they're doing with their agencies and how to comply, you know, with the array of laws and then just a lot of the informal expectations. So that's been the big change in the recent years, is just paying a lot of attention to some of the stuff that isn't specifically statutory language.
Excellent. Thanks. Judd, what about you? What's your definition?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm happy to be here. And, you know, I kind of like how, Mike, how you captured this question and kind of the topic as a whole, because it's forcing me to somewhat predict what my position will look like in a couple of years, or what, you know, credit collections compliance will look like in the near to mid future. I promise you haven't conspired, but I agree with everything Kelly and Alicia both said. I will say, you know, I came into the industry right around the time that the CFPB was rising as this big force within compliance, and the agencies were looking at, well, we need a playbook, we need to follow it, we're going to risk an audit, and that was the scary factor. I think recently it's expanded beyond just this regulatory compliance, where we're worried about lawsuits or legal compliance or facing enforcement or supervisory action or something like that. I've seen, both within my organization and, you know, the industry as a whole, a move to also include corporate compliance or ethical compliance, you know, establishing that compliant culture within your organization. I think that's a very much a top-down way to look at it. You want to get people steered in the right direction, do the right thing, establish your culture, and really try to use that to promote good ethical behavior from throughout the organization. I think that's, you know, it's kind of reflecting an industry reputation change. You know, we're no longer trying to be, well, not that we're trying to be, but I think we're moving past that negative reputation of the bad actors within collection agencies and moving towards much more of an institutional, corporatized industry that has to have these things in place and be good citizens.
It's very interesting to hear the three definitions, if only because they are incredibly comprehensive. And, you know, everybody sort of touched on how this definition is, you know, what constitutes compliance is expanding. And we'll definitely spend some time later on talking about how that, you know, definition, you know, whether you see that definition expanding even further as we move into 2019 and beyond. But I'm curious if any of you view compliance as a binary state, meaning you sort of either are in compliance or are not in compliance, or is it more of a situation where there are degrees of compliance? How do you sort of approach compliance from an objective standpoint versus maybe just sort of a subjective definition? Jeb, what do you think about that?
No, I agree. It's not binary, meaning you either are or you aren't. It's a light switch. I don't think that's the state of it. I think there are degrees. You could say you are legal, and I think that's kind of a more stark comparison. You either are or you aren't. But to be compliant means not just that you're acting legally, but you're also adhering to best practices. And best practices within your organization, within the industry, those are constantly changing and evolving. I'll give you an example that comes to mind. So we monitor all of our calls. So we've got a call monitoring program for all of our consumer communications. And we review them not just for strict legal compliance. So we've got our 7 or 8 checklists. You have to do the X, Y, and Z in every call. But we also monitor it for call quality and look into those best practices. And I think that's really where compliance can give a lot of added value to the organization's operations, where you're meshing and integrating, not just doing things legally, but also doing things the right way, the most efficient way.
I agree with what you're saying, Judd. And I think about, being compliant, I think about it really as more of an evolution, right? So when you're looking at your compliance management system and you're thinking, okay, where am I in this like evolution? You want to be making sure that you are regularly moving towards a better state, right? Towards a place where you can state that you are, more calculative, more proactive than reactive, or than less disciplined. So, there's a stages of a CMS slide that I've used in the past that talk about, the reactive stage, which is where you've started the foundation building, you have developed your policies and procedures, but you're still reactive. You're not taking proactive steps, but you're reacting to something that's already happened. And you want to be moving to a place where you have active leadership involvement, where you're regularly assessing risks and gaps, like in your call monitoring program, where you are further enhancing all elements of your CMS, where you have, competent trained employees, where folks are bringing things to you so that you're taking a proactive step. That's really kind of where you want to be moving the needle, as opposed to thinking that, okay, we're good, right? Because it's constantly a system where you're evaluating, how am I doing? What else am I missing?
And Kelly,
just piggybacking on your comment, Kelly, I think that shows the level, the maturation of your organization, where you've moved beyond just, okay, we're going to fix the things that are going wrong, to being proactive and setting up those processes in place where you can anticipate and be able to be flexible and adaptable with changing circumstances.
And I would agree with both of those comments, and just wanted to make the point also that, it's not always progression in the compliance management system. There's actually regression depending on, what the new expectations are of the regulatory authorities, new case law that comes out. So, you can design your compliance management system and continue on making improvements and enhancements and putting more automation in place and technology controls and whatnot. But, it's a constant state of evaluation. So, in terms of degrees of compliance, absolutely there are, and they can absolutely change at any point in time. So, something we often do is, evaluate different areas of our compliance management system. And in fact, our auditing system has a rating system that would rate our residual risk, which is, your risk to begin with, and then you combine your controls of people, processing, technology, and then you get a residual risk. And that would either be, non-existent, inadequate, adequate, near optimal, or optimal. So, in some situations, an adequate residual risk would be okay, and you can work in the future on near optimal. But when you have other areas of your CMS, once you're reevaluating those, go and regress, then you want to look at those and say, okay, are these more important? Do we need to increase our controls so we can get those back to adequate or near optimal or optimal?
I totally agree with you. I wanted to kind of add, because it made me think of something that Judd said earlier too, that it's also not just about like the laws and cases that are coming out, which of course is a large part of it, but also you can pull in new things as you're thinking about how can I improve my compliance management system. You can think about, okay, what ethics principles do we want to pull into our compliance management system? You know, like the see something, say something, right? If you hear something happening on the call center, how do I know that my employees feel confident to report that? Is my, you know, whistleblower policy strong enough? Is my ethics hotline sufficient? You know, thinking about how to pull those sort of other compliance things in that maybe you weren't thinking were a part of compliance because it's not involving a particular law necessarily. You know, it's something that you should be doing.
Excellent. Well, we've had a great start to the discussion, and I just want to pause for a moment. And what I'd like to do is invite Emily from Arbyte to say a few words. Emily?
Hi, everyone. I'm representing Arbyte today. We are a cloud-based contact provider based in Buffalo, New York. And Arbyte was actually founded by former collection agency owners, and they saw an opportunity to create a more advanced and more powerful broadcast dialer than what they saw in the market when they were running their agency. So right now our dialer is used by more than 250 collection agencies, and our ultimate goal is to make the interaction between agencies and consumers as pleasant as possible by minimizing interruptions and innovating software that's fast and easy to use and accessible. Additionally, right now we're running a promotion until the end of February, so 3 more days. And if you sign up with our dialer, you'll get 6 months of free regional caller IDs. And we also have an office phone system that's very easy to use. And if you sign up with our phone system, we will replace your phone hardware for free. So if you give us a call before Thursday or on Thursday, you can learn more about that.
Excellent. Thanks, Emily, and thank you, Arbyte, for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate your support of an endeavor like this that seeks to educate and inform the entire ARM industry. For more information about the company, you can go to www.arbytesoftware.com. So with respect to compliance, and we've all can safely agree it's a moving target, and there's a need to sort of be as comprehensive and as broad as possible in terms of applying how we've defined compliance to our agencies. What are some of the best ways for a company to stay as close to that bullseye as possible? What are you doing at your agency? What would you like to do? What are you seeing other agencies do? Maybe Alicia, you can go first this time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about this a little bit earlier. You know, we keep a constant pulse on the new case law, the new consent orders. There are ways to sign up for, announcements that come from the FTC, FCC, the CFPB. I get all of those emails daily in my Outlook. Keep a pulse on some of the rulings that are coming out. Also, Mike Gibbs' daily emails are also very informative. I have many peers that are willing to share insights. I don't know how many times a week I'll just send out a random question to a couple different people and just get their perspective. Judd and Kelly have been great for that in the past. And then also, you know, obviously belonging to some other member groups such as ACA, Inside ARM's Compliance Professionals Forum, or Consumer Relations Consortium is also a great resource. I think just building a variety of different sources where you're getting information fed to you and then also having the option to then seek out information from some of your peers are really the best way to stay as close to the bullseye as possible. You need to make sure that you have some diversity in the information that you're getting and just some different perspectives.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. RMA also has, you know, regular webinars like ACA and Mike Gibbs' webinar series. The certification standards that RMA has is another good tool to use to make sure that you're implementing the best practices. One of the biggest challenges I think that we have as an industry is trying to figure out where the plaintiff's bar is going to go next and how to make sure that the content of our communication with consumers is, up to date and not, confusing or misleading. And it's really difficult to do that when, you have shifting landscapes and shifting sands and different opinions coming out from the different circuits. And I'm thinking, of course, now of the bubbling trouble that's happening in Pennsylvania and New Jersey regarding whether or not the validation language itself, the language that we all copy from the statute, is confusing and whether or not that misleads consumers. And what do we do about that? Do we create another notice to put at the bottom for just, folks in New Jersey and Pennsylvania? That's some of the hardest things that I struggle with on a day-to-day basis that I think would surprise people outside the industry. And I don't think people realize that we spend so much time focusing on, making sure that, the word balance, should it be balanced due? Should it be current balance? Should it just be plain balance? And, I think that's one of the challenges that I think about regularly, but because of all of those resources out there, it makes it easier for us to do our jobs and to do that.
Mike, I really have nothing to add to what Kelly and Alicia both said. I will, I guess, underscore and reemphasize the networking side of it. So, Yeah, we can read the news and read the court decisions, enforcement actions, but really, to know where that baseline is drawn, you really need to be involved with your peer groups, with your industry advocacy groups, and then take home what you've learned and implement it. To me, that's the sounding board, and that's the ability to be able to distinguish what a judge in some random district might say versus what is actually allowable or practical in practice.
Well said. Alicia, going back to what you said about, sort of getting all of that information, all the sources you listed, including I'm just as guilty as anybody else of sending a lot of emails out there. There's a lot of information that could get sort of put into your inbox on a daily basis. Is there a process that you have to sort of parse it, to sort of triage it, prioritize it? How do you sort of work your way through all of that information?
Yeah, good question. I personally have some rules set up in my Outlook that flag certain things. So if it was, an FCRA consent order that would come in, that would flag it and keep it in my inbox. Otherwise, it kind of takes the different industry news and places it in folders. And then I take some time that I just dedicate to reviewing those sources. And the reason being is oftentimes when you're getting flooded with emails throughout the day and you have, 10 different meetings and 2 meetings at the same time, and you're trying to stay up on your emails, you're going to miss pieces of information that are in those informational emails that are going to be very beneficial to your agency and your CMS. So I personally just have a organization system, and then again, take some time at least once a week to then go through all of those different folders and read specifically the content and ensure that I'm reviewing that and putting it into our CMS and making those considerations.
And then is that something sort of everybody at the company does, or do you sort of filter it out from there and say, if you come across something that needs to be addressed within the company, is that sort of, sort of send the bat signal up at that point?
So my team, I encourage them to implement a very similar strategy. And then we also have dedicated meetings to discussion on different items that we've received weekly. And then at the operational and compliance interaction level, we have our compliance committee meeting where we talk about different items if they aren't immediately urgent. And then I also have a quote board of directors meeting where different things would be able to be flagged monthly as well. So it really just depends on the degree of importance, but my team personally, I encourage them to take the time and dedicate, at least an hour a week to sit down and review a lot of the content that's coming.
Excellent. Kelly, you brought up letters, so I'm not going to be, you know, accused of bringing this up. But with respect to specifically this letter debate, because it's clearly an issue that's affecting a lot of companies across the country, what compliant is versus what compliant, you know, what isn't compliant with respect to these letters is very much throwing a dart at a dartboard and hoping you're getting it right. So when it comes to sort of wondering whether or not this is going to be compliant, what's the process that an agency should take to sort of do its best, you know, its best analysis that what it, you know, whatever change it's going to make is going to be as close to compliant as possible and maybe not run into the same problem that other companies are running into?
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple of rules that folks can follow, especially when it comes to different cases coming out about evolving case law. And that's, you know, first, make sure that you have a couple of trusted friends or advisors, you know, that you can go to ask like super open-ended questions about stuff. Like, you know, if you have an issue with the changing balance that's going to happen, you know, so that you can email people and say, hey, you know, we're going to take this placement from this new client and this is what's happening. And what do you think about this kind of thing? Because you're going to get different feedback from folks. That's going to be really helpful to you when trying to make those decisions. Having a trusted outside counsel that you like, that you can go to with those sort of questions, I think is also really important. I clearly need to learn from Alicia how to organize my email so that things get automatically placed into folders. That sounds amazing. So using technology to assist you in your job would be another big one, I think, that would be helpful. Generally, my rule is I'm not going to add any new language to my letter unless something, you know, unless a couple of people have suggested, yeah, you should definitely add this new language, because usually when you add new language, you just get yourself into more trouble. You know, that's sort of my default position for letters.
Okay. John, wondering how you would sort of approach that same kind of situation where compliance might not necessarily be black or white. How do you recommend companies interpret a new law or ruling in order to determine how to react, if at all?
Yeah, you know, with the I guess the problem comes in the details of, you know, we can intake all the information we can, and all of us subscribe to multiple email services and read different publications, but it's really what you do with that information that becomes the difficult side of that. You know, for us, if I serve and my department serves as that intake, so it is our responsibility to stay abreast of changes and developments and then get a sense of what should happen based on that. But really to look at implementation, you know, not every court decision means you have to change, stop the presses, and make changes immediately. I never want us to be a trailblazer in that regard. I want to see how things shake out. I want to see how a court decision or an enforcement action or an agency decision might be interpreted. But we really need to partner with our operations people to determine the best solution based on what we've been able to intake. So, you know, not everything is black and white in the sense that, well, a judge says you can't do this anymore, so you need to stop it. To me, really, that would be a guidance. And then you really need to look at, well, is that the logical conclusion? Is that going to be followed by other jurisdictions? What's the cost of that compliance? Does the cost, is it outweighed by the benefit of making any changes institutionally or organizationally? Things that, you know, it becomes a discussion, I guess, is my point. That really needs to be had at the most senior level. So you've got to have that communications channel established with your senior decision makers within the organization and be able to really have your input from the compliance perspective on what these changes are and what you would recommend, but really work together to determine what that solution is going to be, if anything.
You brought up the issue of cost, and I think that's a good topic to maybe spend a couple of minutes on, because sometimes you can sort of look at compliance and say, okay, we have to do this. But as we talked about, not everything's black or white. So maybe it's a should we do this? And I'm curious how each of you, do you have a cost benefit analysis approach when evaluating an expense that's sort of under the umbrella of compliance, or is it just if we need it, yes or no, then we have to get it? And I'll leave that open for anybody who wants to jump on that one first.
Well, since you mentioned cost benefit analysis, or since I mentioned it, I'll go ahead and say we actually do a cost benefit analysis. That's part of a written recommendation or proposal. If we look at new solutions or compliance solutions as a possibility, I want to get that that analysis performed, so we really know where it lays and where it's going to hit the bottom line. I think our senior leadership would be doing a disservice if they didn't require that to be part of the steps we undertake. If you're talking about what the cost is versus what the benefit is, it's more than just monetary. It's more than just, I will save this number of dollars in litigation expenses or whatever it may be at the cost of whatever the price is for that solution. You also need to keep in mind, what are your intangible costs, such as client relations? How are they going to view it? Reputation in the community, reputation in the industry, all those other things, what opportunities would you be foregoing if you went down the road of a certain solution? So all those things really need to take into place or need to take into account and have that all weighed together to determine what your strategy is going to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. We do a cost benefit analysis too. And I think that a lot of times when you're compliance and you're going and asking for more money for something, compliance costs have skyrocketed. And so we always talk a lot about, how to prove that what you are doing is saving your company money and that the return on investment that you get for compliance is, tenfold, and figuring out ways to actually show that to folks who are going to be approving your budgetary expense when you come and say, hey, I really think I need this. I make an effort to try and be super scrappy as often as possible and think, how can I do whatever it is that I need to do? How can I do it better with less resources? What can we automate in an easy fashion? How can we improve this process so that less people are having to touch this, so that there are less steps involved? I think of, processing disputes and those dispute letters that we get in from certain companies where folks are getting, hundreds of thousands of them in a particular week, and how to handle that in a way that isn't going to, crush the productivity of your business. And thinking about unique ways to do that. Those are things that a lot of folks in the industry have been talking about lately. And it's helpful, again, to turn to the folks in your group. I think I remember calling Alicia when we started credit reporting at my last agency to be like, how can I do this in a cost efficient manner because of all the different EOSCAR steps that you need to go through and putting your eyes on documents and stuff. So thinking outside the box and getting folks on your team used to thinking about and constantly reflecting on, okay, we've set this up. This has been working for, X number of days now. What can we do to make this process more efficient? That's what I like to do.
And I completely agree with you, Kelly. I think that, one of the ways that you can think about some of those things is, do we really need to do this through automation, or can this be a manual control, or could we, set up some procedures, some job aids? One of the things that I think back to was this big boom with Regulation E, and that, you really need to send them written documentation of this recurring payment arrangement that they've made. Some companies took a look at that and said, well, do we really have to send this written confirmation, or could we build it into a script and build that script into our Notcha script and kind of combine it all? That way you get all of that information together, use the combination of people controls and technology controls to pop that script and, still be in compliance. So I think there, when you're doing a cost-benefit analysis, as Judd and Kelly have both said, you really need to think through the possibilities of solutions and the degree of controls that you want to put on those solutions, because some controls are much more expensive. You know, if you have to have dedicated IT time to build to, or even to over-engineer this control that really isn't that much of a risk to your company, why are you dedicating, you know, IT resources to that? Why aren't you just putting in some type of manual controls and some good auditing to make sure that that's happening? So I think that that's a very important part of this analysis and proposal and partnering with operations that needs to be considered.
You know, Mike, one thing that I think is important that I want to make sure we don't lose sight of, you always want to get the benefit of getting buy-in from others within your organization, especially outside of compliance, from the call center, from your operations folk. I never wanted to put myself in the position where compliance says we need this, everybody is upset about it, but you know, what are we gonna do, and have that decision be made. If you can get, you know, agreement on multiple fronts, that makes the decision process a lot easier, and certainly it's better to have a consensus than to have a dictation.
I think that's a great point. Go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I think helps identify the things that I think Alicia actually had in her definition, like people, processes, and technology or automation of compliance, to add those pieces to your risk assessment. Like when you're identifying what the risk is to your organization and whatever risk it is that you're looking at, and you're saying, okay, what assets does this impact? You want to say, is this process a people process? Is it manual? Is it automated? What technology is involved? So that when you're evaluating that risk, you can go back when you're looking at your controls and say, okay, what additional things can we do to maybe move this from 100% manual to, you know, some automation, you know, if that makes sense. You know, adding those additional sort of things to look at in your risk assessment makes it easier to evaluate the risk and to see maybe where you might have some places where you can have some movement to make your controls even stronger.
I think that's a really important thing to remember is, you know, we're in the job not of risk elimination, but of risk management. So finding out what level of risk is tolerable for your organization is important. And an example popped into my head, you know, the state of Rhode Island recently passed a new rule mandating that call recordings have to be kept for 5 years, which is a very long time. And that's also a very expensive standard to uphold. So depending on if your agency, for instance, has any significant work in Rhode Island, it may be cheaper for you to not take accounts in that state or to forward them to another agency rather than comply with that rule. So you really need to take a cautioned, reasoned approach to these and not just knee-jerk into, well, such and such says this, therefore we have to do it.
Yeah, for sure. And I wrote that down. Thanks for telling me. I appreciate that. I'm going to check that out. It immediately made me think, ooh, and how does this law comply with, you know, the new data protection law that California is rolling out where I may have to delete someone's data upon their request? As many states such as Rhode Island and New York have requirements for keeping that information. And hopefully we can make it clear to our California Attorney General's office that we need to comply with those laws and that that should for sure be an exception to a consumer requesting that something be deleted.
I think automation is a great topic. In fact, I think it's so great. I'm actually doing a webinar on it tomorrow, as you may have seen through on the slides that are scrolling through. So feel free to sign up for that one. I'm looking forward to that conversation as well. Alicia, circling back to what you said about sort of this whole idea of manual versus automation, by, you know, trying not to put you on the spot too much, but is there a situation where you can, you know, sort of provide an example or some sort of situation where you've sort of had that conversation or that debate and sort of ended up going one way or the other?
Yeah. You know, one thing that I wanted to kind of emphasize in the last discussion and bridges over perfectly to this is discussing the solutions that are being proposed with your operational partners. You know, they have a wealth of information. They understand exactly how this is going to impact the day-to-day. So it's very important that when you're making all of these proposals and looking at, you know, an estimate of what you think the compliance related expense is going to be, you know, consideration is going to be the impact to operations and, you know, the average talk time that the collector will have on the phone and the increase in the amount of different scripting that the representative is going to have and how that may throw off the flow of the collection call. And so when you ask, for example, so we had a situation recently with statute of limitations. And so for a long time, we've had requirements that on our letters for any accounts that are outside of the statute of limitations that we include a disclosure. Very similar to the asset acceptance disclosure that was mandated by the FTC in their consent order against asset acceptance, has a little bit of additional detail on, you know, what the creditor can do and information on credit reporting based on the age of the debt. And so we looked at that and we started getting some lawsuits on different scripts related to the statute of limitations when there's a verbal conversation. So we had a couple different scenarios come up where the account, when we sent a letter, was not past the statute of limitations. And then, you know, a couple months later, it had aged past the account, past the statute of limitations, and we hadn't sent another letter, but we'd had a conversation. And so we started receiving some lawsuits on, well, you didn't ever make my client aware, and, you know, you should have provided some information that this account was past the statute of limitations. So that's kind of one of those areas. It's, again, not a statutory requirement. It's something that has been written into a consent order against another company, and we've taken that and adapted it to our written communication, but now we're seeing it come into our verbal communication. So we sat down and talked with operations about some of the risk related to this, some of the expense related to, you know, scripting this scenario and, you know, how we should build it out. And we came to a solution that, you know, in different situations, we would provide a technology control that would calculate if it was past statute of limitations and a script would pop for the collectors because it was that important to us to avoid that risk and take just the minimal amount of time that that script was going to take for the collectors to communicate it. So that's a very recent example that I think is, you know, a strong consideration as to whether or not you automate that and have that script pop, or you have some type of job aid where the collector could consider, you know, numerous different scenarios and try to real time, you know, understand what they should say to this consumer in kind of a difficult situation.
Yeah, I agree. That's really important, particularly right now. I've noticed that a number of our clients have asked us to update our script to incorporate perhaps in out of statute contexts, not perhaps, but to actually incorporate some sort of disclosure about, you know, if a partial payment is going to impact the account and, you know, incorporating what the client themselves does, you know, while a partial payment may retoll the statute of limitations, we never use a partial payment to retoll the statute of limitations, which I think has been very interesting. That's another way to kind of keep up on compliance stuff is when your clients are sending you different requirements that they would like you to enact and put as part of your policies and procedures with their accounts, because that often shows you something that they think is really important and that you should be thinking about across all clients, depending on whether or not you think it was a good suggestion.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I just wanted to break from my questions, I want to ask one of the questions that's come in from the audience, A, so we can get to it, but B, also just to remind everybody, we've got a few minutes left, so if you have a question for Judd, Kelly, or Alicia, or all of them, type it into your Zoom webinar control panel now, and we'll do our best to get to it before the end of the webinar. But the question is, for all the panelists, what is that one item that you wish you had your arms around better in your compliance program?
Oh, I have this one. So for me, and I think this kind of overlaps with what is my, you know, my greatest fear, worry going forward, just for this industry compliance wise, now in the foreseeable future, to me, it's going to be data security and consumer protection. That's the big issue that's going to really be both an exposure issue, but also a complex regulatory issue. Kelly mentioned the California law on consumer information, and that's just, I can't imagine that that's going to be the only development in that area. So on the data security side, we have most states have their own data security laws, and we have no unifying standard there. And that is even not even including international standards, such as GDPR. So that's really, I don't speak zeros and ones, and there are so many complex standards in place, not just state laws and regulations, but if you look at HITRUST or PCI DSS and SOC 2 standards and that type of thing, there's a lot out there. And it just seems like that's a big area that can trip up an agency, and it's almost too much for one person to really get their hands around. If your organization is big enough, I would definitely recommend you have a very capable, knowledgeable chief information officer or a chief information security officer that really takes that by the reins and handles that area.
And I want to just chime in, like, in terms of big enough, a lot, I've heard a lot of talk about, you know, I don't think that GDPR applies to me, or, oh, I don't know that I'm big enough. Well, so the GDPR applies to any European Union citizen, right? So if they're living in Florida and they're a citizen of the European Union, that's where they do their winters in Florida, and they've been offered a credit card that you're collecting on, GDPR absolutely will apply to you. The other thing that's important to note there too is that, like with California's rule, it seems like California's law is going to apply to anyone who has 50,000 records of consumer information, which certainly seems to me that it would fall under most collection agencies. And I know that their definition isn't very clear, and people have sought, you know, does that just mean California records, or does that mean records of any consumer? And so we don't really know a lot of the answers to it. So definitely that's a big thing to pay attention to this coming year. It's going to be a big deal. Plus, we're going to have the CFPB rulemaking hopefully come out really soon, like in the next couple of weeks.
So that's perfect. Perfect bridge to what I was going to say is that I wish I understood better kind of what the rulemaking was going to include. We do have a variety of sources and some information we've received a couple of years ago, some updates on that based on, you know, the survey they issued. But that's something that I wish I had a better grasp on, to just anticipate how we might change things and some of the opportunities that we might gain in terms of technological advances from some of the rules. So I guess mine's not entirely negative from a, you know, I this one really keeps me up at night, but I do wish that I just had a better understanding of what those rules might be, so we could better anticipate how we were going to move forward once those come out.
You know, Alicia, that totally makes me think of it, because I've been thinking about this ever since seeing this question pop up about what's the one item that I wish I had my arms around better. And I've been really thinking about that. One of the things that came out of that, you know, outline for the proposed debt collection rulemaking was that, and maybe also from kind of watching the consent orders that come out and talking to folks who've, you know, perhaps been visited by the CFPB, is the fact that the CFPB or BCFP thinks that there's a lot of pieces of information that we should be tracking, you know, like capturing consent, you know, to email a consumer, or capturing consent to text a consumer, capturing, you know, how did the dispute actually come to your office, right? Did the dispute come in over the phone? Did the dispute come in over the email? Did they dispute through your website? The one thing that I kind of have a goal of for this year is trying to make sure that we have enough ways to document how we're capturing information that we're getting from the consumer, so that we can pull statistics from that and kind of evaluate it on a larger level. Because if you're just, anytime a dispute comes in, you just mark the account as disputed, it doesn't necessarily mean that you know how that dispute came in. And so thinking about ways to enhance your system so that you can be tracking, you know, consumer preferences in a way that allows you to really pull important information from that, right? Anything that's written in the account notes is going to be hard for you to extrapolate information from. So trying to figure out ways to gather that information by, you know, having enough boxes where you can check in your collection software systems.
And I would also agree with that, Kelly, that's a really good point in terms of data collection. You know, what reports should I be paying the most attention to? How should those reports be designed to be able to provide me, you know, risk elements in my CMS? What do I not currently have in my collection system that I'll need for, you know, the reports to evaluate my CMS properly? That is something that is constantly evolving and that, you know, I'm not sure we'll ever have a true handle on, because there's always more enhancements to make and always more data to receive, and your clients continue to send more data and there are more expectations from regulators as to data you should consume. But that's one item that certainly we continue to work on year after year after year.
Another question's come in. Maybe each of the panelists can spend just a second or a minute, or maybe more than a second, talking about how their compliance departments are structured. How many employees do you have that are dedicated to compliance tasks, and what types of positions they are?
Sure.
Anyone want to tackle that one first?
Yeah. I'm trying to write down. So we have about seven people in our compliance department. Essentially that's made up of the chief compliance officer, who I report directly to. And we have two attorneys. We have two paralegals, one who focuses specifically on litigation and contract work, and another one who sort of focuses on vendor management and the operations of the legal team as a unit, keeping us focused on our tasks and audits, our external audits that come in. We have an internal auditor as part of our compliance team. And then we have, you know, a policies and procedures expert who is, you know, tasked with making sure that he fully understands not only our own policies and procedures, but our clients' policies and procedures and requirements, so that when we're either onboarding a new client or when we get an update from like a service level agreement of one of our clients, that we're identifying those gaps, fixing any gaps, evaluating whether our own policies and procedures need to be changed as a result of that, how that change will look, and driving that change through the organization.
I will say our compliance department comprises about 3% of our headcount for the company as a whole. So yeah, I guess that might be a good barometer to feel if you're overstaffed or understaffed. It generally works for us. The functions that report up through the department, the broad ones are call monitoring. We have internal audit as well, the consumer complaints, and then training actually as a dotted line to compliance, because so much of our new hire and annual and continual training is a compliance function. So we make sure that that's part of our responsibility as well.
So my structure is very similar to Judd's. I have a regulatory side and then also an audit side. I'm myself a compliance manager, an audit lead, and a regulatory lead. And then the regulatory leads team is in charge of licensing, litigation, and consumer escalation, whether it be through complaints or verbally. And then we have an audit team that's dedicated to all of our various audit functions. And then we also have some individuals that have multiple responsibilities. We kind of share different responsibilities for policy and procedure throughout my organization, and a few other CMS elements are kind of cross-trained across the different individuals in my department.
Excellent. John, we got a question about Rhode Island call recording bill you mentioned. Do you have any more details on that right now off the top of your head? Judd? Still there? We might have lost Judd.
Sorry, I was talking on mute. I apologize. I just typed in a citation to that in the chat box or in the Q&A box. So okay. If that doesn't come through, let me know.
Appreciate it. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left before we wrap up for today. But before we close the call, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and have them share any last words, parting thoughts, anything they wanted to address there but maybe didn't get a chance to, anything like that before we wrap up today's webinar. Kelly, would you mind going first?
Again, Kelly going first, sure. I'd be happy to go first. So I think the thing that I'm trying to do apart from the managing of data and making sure that we have enough ways to capture, fields to capture information that we're getting from consumers so that we can evaluate, how things are happening. The other thing that I'm really trying to do this year is figure out a way to sort of automate and evaluate the controls that we've put in place as a result of our risk assessment to see if they're working, properly. So, if our control is making sure that we are, sending an initial demand within 2 days of placement, and we have reports that are regularly run to make sure that's happening. Is there a better way to be doing that? Is that report actually working? Is someone actually looking at that? I know that's sort of like an internal auditor function, but thinking about automated ways in which we can report back on the success of the controls that we have is something I'm really focused and interested on. So if anybody has ideas and are doing things in that regard, please let me know. I'm super interested in that.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you, Kelly. Alicia, what about you?
I would say that my comment is very similar to Kelly's. One of the things that we've really focused on in the past, I would say 2 years, is enhancement to our auditing system and inspecting what you expect and figuring out ways to template some of our audits and have them kind of create a state of the CMS. So Kelly, I might have some information for you, but I will also take any information you get as a result of that solicitation. I think it's very important to understand, if what you've designed is adequate and determine whether or not that's going to be sufficient for your CMS and whether or not the controls that you have in place are going to be what you want to move forward with, or if there's, a redesign that should take place. So the auditing is definitely something I would emphasize as well.
Excellent. Judd, you get the last word today.
Definitely, me too on the auditing component. There's just really no substitution for being able to not only self-monitor, but self-audit. You need to dig deep and find out where those breakdowns and gaps exist. And there's no way to do that without taking a step back and having someone ask those questions and turn over those rocks. I think, for me, for us, and what I see a lot as a work in progress, in my head, I'm going back to one of the things Kelly mentioned at the beginning of the webinar, and that's we've moved from a situation of being responsive or reactive to situations. Lawsuit comes in, we figure out what went wrong and defend it, to being more proactive. So, being able to issue spot, identify those breakdowns before they become problems, identify those changes that need to be implemented or integrated before they become litigation. Having both those processes in place to identify and implement, and also having the staff trained so that they can do that effectively. I think that's where, on the maturity curve of an organization, that's where a lot of us lay now. We've learned about the FDCPA, we've learned about the TCPA, we've learned how to deal with federal and state regulators, but really having that internal culture in place to be able to evolve and react, or not evolve and react, evolve and be proactive going forward is really the key I see.
Excellent. Well, before I let everyone go, I want to thank Kelly, Alicia, and Judd one more time for their insights and their perspective. I would not have been able to do this webinar without them, so I can't thank them enough for their participation today. Also wanted to thank Arbyte Software one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.arbytesoftware.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. One final reminder, please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar for a chance to win a Starbucks gift card. And more importantly for me, the opportunity to help identify topics and speakers that will be of the most importance to you going forward. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of the day. Kelly, Jed, Alicia, thank you guys very much. Look forward to talking to you all again soon.
Thanks, Mike.
Have a great day, everyone.
Bye, everybody.